it's probably, you know, I don't know. I'm not, I don't want to assume that everyone knows who the New York School of Poets are, so I'm going to do a little bit of just kind of outlining some of the stuff. So it's not actually a school. It's a school in the sense that the School of Paris is a school. It's an aesthetic movement. But what it is a kind of group of friends, like many aesthetic movements. It's composed of a group of people who became friends, and their relationships in some ways have the intensity of, one feels, because they all lived in New York, had the intensity of a kind of village life. You know, it actually feels sort of very intimate and small scale. So the four main figures in the movement are Frank O'Hara, John Ashbery, Kenneth Koch, and James Schuyler. Ashbery, O'Hara, and Koch were all undergraduates at Harvard in the late 1940s. They all worked, I believe. They were not all there simultaneously. I believe that Koch and Ashbery were there initially. Koch left to go to New York. Ashbery was still there. And then O'Hara came. And there's a famous letter in which O'Hara writes to Koch and says, I believe we've got a contender. You know, he's just met O'Hara. And you know, he kind of recognizes his genius. What's interesting is that O'Hara and Koch had been in the service in World War II. So they were slightly older, actually, than Ashbery. And they were older, obviously, than a lot of undergraduates. But they're sort of typical of that generation of servicemen returning, you know, after the war and kind of resuming their education. All had moved to New York by the early 1950s, okay? In a way, they're sort of simultaneously outsiders and insiders. They're outsiders in the sense that three of them are gay, you know, at a time when, you know, it was quite dangerous, actually, to be openly gay. O'Hara, Ashbery, and Schuyler. And then Koch, as a Jew at Harvard, I mean, one of the things to remember about Harvard is that it was, I think, in the early 1940s, they still had quotas on Jews, you know, who could enroll as students at the university. In some sense, there's this sort of sense of, and he'd come from Cincinnati, so he wasn't an East Coast person to begin with. So there's some sense of them, you know, sort of on the a little bit on the margins of things, but they're also insiders in the sense that once they moved to New York, they're very much a part of this, what was probably one of the most amazing art scenes of the 20th century. And, you know, always tell my students, if you could pick a time to live in, you know, you'd either want to live in Paris in the first couple of decades of the century, or you'd want to live in New York in, you know, the 1940s, late 1940s, and into the 50s and early 60s. And so they're part of this whole world, and it's the world of the abstract expressionists, the action painters, and then a little bit later, pop artists. So it's, you know, people like Franz Klein, Jackson Pollock, de Kooning, Larry Rivers, Red Grooms, and then a lot of musicians, people like John Cage, for instance, you know, are around at the same time. All the beat poets are kind of in and out of the scene. O'Hara and Ginsberg became very, very close. There's a sort of cross-fertilization of ideas that are going on, you know, constantly. A lot of them met at the Cedar Tavern, you know, which is a very famous bar that all the painters and writers hung out with. And you really have, when you read interviews with these people, you really have this sense that they both, that the painters and the writers were really listening to each other and really got a huge amount from each other. O'Hara and Ashbery became fairly well recognized and important art critics, actually, at a certain point in the 1950s. And O'Hara eventually, he started working at the Museum of Modern Art, and as did Schuyler. O'Hara eventually became a curator at the museum, and he remained a curator until he died. He died sort of tragically in 1965, I believe. It could have been maybe 66. He was at a party late at night on Fire Island, and there had been like a somebody's car had the tire had gone flat, and they got out to change it, and he was hit by another car that came over a dune, and he died a couple of days later. The Black Mountain Poets, the Beats, and the New York School Poets were all part of a kind of continuum, as I said, you know, on the sort of left wing of American poetry. And that continuum is represented by an anthology, okay, that comes out in 1960, which is Don Allen's The New American Poetry, 1945 to 1960, which was a groundbreaking anthology, hugely influential, and contained almost all of these figures from these movements. So there is this sort of sense of, again, they're part of something that, while its scale isn't huge in comparison to the rest of the country, it has an intensity that makes it feel like the most important thing in the world, and to be it's the most important place to be. And when you there's a wonderful book actually if you're interested in reading more about them and about this particular time in New York, there's a book by David Lehman called The Last Avant-Garde. Which I would recommend, which is both a kind of analytical book about the work that was being done then by somebody who's not an academic critic, you know, somebody who's just a really smart guy who can talk about this stuff really well, and also a sort of biographical book, you know, about the lives of these people. So I want to just briefly, before we get to the poems, really quickly just outline the aesthetic values of the New York School. So, talk is at the heart of it. You know, a sort of, Tony Hoagland has a great phrase for it, fast talking. You know, there's a kind of speed to it. There's a kind of, also a kind of glibness and a kind of sense of American idiom, a real sense of playfulness, and a sort of pleasure in that idiom. And it's, you also have this sort of sense of personality expressing itself through talk. You know, and it seems utterly American in that way, and completely down to earth. The talk in itself kind of pegs the whole thing. It strips a lot of rhetorical surface out of the poetry. Okay, so in a sense, it's completely antithetical to a lot of the work that was being done in the 1940s and 1950s by mainstream American poets who were very influenced by something called New Criticism, which basically argued that. Poetry, in order for a poem to be a good poem, it needed a very dense sonic surface. It needed a lot of levels of information that is sort of encoded in allusion and irony and a sort of sense of restraint also. A certain kind of slight formality, I guess, would be the right way to say it. So form and shaping in a traditional sense, metered, rhymed often, you know. So what the New York School poets are doing is opposed to that, you know. And their influences kind of leapfrog backwards towards the earlier part of the century, in particular the French poet Apollinaire. You know, for O'Hara becomes like a huge, and Ashbery is fluent in French, so he's reading, you know, sort of constantly and translating. O'Hara was actually quite fluent in French as well. So they're very influenced by surrealism. A lot of the work that I'm going to present tonight from the New York School poets is not the more surreal stuff that they did, but they did do a lot of Koch in particular, and O'Hara, you know, and Ashbery, you know, all did stuff that was really quite quite influenced by the surrealists. So anyway, what are the other values? Sociability and amusement, pleasure, saying yes, you know, the great yes. I once met somebody who had Koch as a teacher at Columbia, and as an undergraduate, and she had brought him a bunch of poems in one day, and she said, you know, they were pretty typical undergraduate, you know, stormy relationship, you know, dark times poems. And Koch read a few of them, and he looked at her, and he just smiled, and he said, "Don't you ever say yes?" And in some way, that was one of the sort of projects of the New York School of Poets, to not see life as a tragedy, you know, but to see what was in it on a daily basis as a kind of ongoing pleasure that should be recognized. That material deserved to be in poetry. And in a way, what they're doing is kind of enlarging the sphere of subject matter. Okay, it's one way to think about it. So the aesthetic really emphasizes spontaneity, immediacy, improvisation. Surprise is a huge value for the New York School of Poets. They want to surprise themselves. You know, what they're doing is kind of an amplified version of what Frost talks about. Frost says, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So your job is to make those surprises occur in the act of writing a poem. The New York School of Poets really sort of amplified that. And they're very interested in sort of the immediacy of the poem, the immediacy of the moment in which the poem is being written. Okay, that's where you locate yourself. You know, the poem does not refer to something that happens outside of it. It's all happening in this moment of the poem. And that's an idea that's shared very commonly, you know, by that constellation of poets in Don Allen's anthology, the New York School Poets and Beats and the Black Mountain Poets. So it tends to be very fast. It tends to move in unexpected directions. It often is kind of fragmented. Some of what they were doing depended on effects that they had picked up from Apollinaire and then the Surrealists, which involved collage techniques. O'Hara has another great line, you know, in a poem. He says, "My strength is in my mobility." My strength is in my mobility. And in some sense, the movement of the poems is what's really important in them. Ordinary life tends to be its subject. So O'Hara has a series of poems called Lunch Poems, that, as you will hear when he reads this first poem. He's talking about the act of writing them. So it's this sort of sense, he said, I do these poems. They're I do this, I do that poems. You know, that's all they are. There's no plot to them, you know. There's no problem that needs to be solved. There's no, they don't have to make an important statement about life. They just have to be in life, okay, and get as much of that as they can, to be as alive as they can. And in a way, what they're doing is they're sort of puncturing the very serious surface of high modernism. So this is where postmodernism begins in a lot of ways. For good and bad. There's something really deceptively subversive about all this, though, because I think what they're really about is a sort of sense that, well, one thing they're doing is kind of redefining the beautiful in poetry, the sublime, and they are bringing all of this stuff into poetry to be considered as beautiful, to be valued. So they're rescuing something in that sense. They're rescuing pieces of life. And what, you know, as I said before, what appears to be nothing special is special because basically it's 99% of life and it's vanishing. It's ephemeral. It's just disappearing. So there's something mildly Buddhist about all of this. I have a friend, Linda Bamber, who teaches at Tufts, and she teaches a course on Buddhism and American poetry, and she talks a lot about the New York School Poets as people who are very much, you know, in a sort of tradition whose ideas can be traced back in some sense to Buddhism, even though, you know, probably they were never directly influenced. This stuff was in the air, I have to say that. Cage, all of the painters were sort of listening to stuff. This is the sort of time of also Alan Watts, you know, kind of introducing Zen, and D.T. Suzuki, you know, introducing Zen in America. So, having said all that, I want to just look at the poems and see, you know, how those poems embody some of those values. So I'm going to play a recording of O'Hara reading Adieu to Norman, Bonjour to Jean. It should be, Joan and Jean-Paul.
But the next poem is one of a series of poems that I wrote at work on my lunch hour, which City Lights is going to publish next year under the title Lunch Poems, because Ferlinghetti thought it was so amusing that anyone was sitting around typing during their lunch hour. So he said, why don't you put them together and we'll publish them as lunch poems. This one is called Adieu to Norman, Bonjour to Joan and Jean-Paul. It's for a friend of mine who was going to France, and I had to hurry up and do it because I was having a farewell lunch with him. It is 12:10 in New York, and I am wondering if I will finish this in time to meet Norman for lunch. Ah, lunch. I think I am going crazy. What with my terrible hangover and the weekend coming up at excitement-prone Kenneth Cokes, I wish I was staying in town and working on my poems at Jones' studio for a new book by Grove Press, which they will probably not print. But it is good to be several floors up in the dead of night, wondering whether you are any good or not. And the only decision you can make is that you did it. Yesterday, I looked up the Rue Frémicourt on a map and was happy to find it like a bird flying over Paris, et ses environs, which unfortunately did not include Seine-et-Oise, which I don't know, as well as a number of other things. And Alan is back talking about God a lot, and Peter is back not talking very much, and Joe has a cold and is not coming to Kenneth, although he is coming to lunch with Norman. I suspect he is making a distinction. Well, who isn't? I wish I were reeling around Paris instead of reeling around New York. I wish I weren't reeling at all. It is spring. The ice has melted. The Ricard is being poured. We are all happy and young and toothless. It is the same as old age. The only thing to do is simply continue. Is that simple? Yes, it is simple because it is the only thing to do. Can you do it? Yes, you can because it is the only thing to do. Blue light over the Bois de Boulogne, it continues. The Seine continues. The Louvre stays open, it continues. It hardly closes at all. The Bar Americain continues to be French. De Gaulle continues to be Algerian, as does Camus. Shirley Goldfarb continues to be Shirley Goldfarb. And Jane Hazen continues to be Jane Frolicker, I think. And Irving Sandler continues to be the balayeur des artistes, and so do I. Sometimes I think I'm in love with painting. And surely the Piscine d'Aligny continues to have water in it, and the floor continues to have tables and newspapers and people under them. And surely we shall not continue to be unhappy. We shall be happy, but we shall continue to be ourselves. Everything continues to be possible. René Char, Pierre Reverdy, Samuel Beckett, it is possible, isn't it? I love Reverdy for saying yes, though I don't believe it.
So there's, you know, a huge number of things to say about this. I do this, I do that poem. But the way it begins certainly is a kind of classic and much imitated strategy. It is 12:10 in New York, and I am wondering if I will finish this in time to meet Norman for lunch. So there's this sort of sense, you know, that what you're getting is a kind of almost like the raw data of the experience of the poet in that particular moment. And the sort of notation of time, there's quite a number of O'Hara poems that begin with a notation of time, many of these lunch poems, actually. And you see it in as a strategy that starts popping up in second-generation New York School poets like Ted Berrigan. Kind of, you know, it immediately becomes like an identifying mark for the New York School as a strategy. And you get in the first couple of stanzas alone a sort of sense of a mind jumping around, not a mind organizing itself in a sort of essayistic, you know, rational way, not organizing it in, you know, using, for instance, the argumentative structure of a sonnet, not at all sort of attempting to give it a form that it doesn't possess in and of itself. So the idea of organic form, you know, is something that's in the air at this point for a lot of people in all the arts.